We hope this explanation of God's Word enriches your life. To help you understand the audience for this talk, we suggest you read the context material on the About Us page. Please read also our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material from philipjensen.com.
Thank you, Peter, and thank you for the invitation from the Evangelical Union to come and share with you, and I'm sorry for the discomfort that we feel, and it's a very friendly place though, isn't it? Because you don't often get called upon to move in such close quarters with your neighbours as you have today. It depends who you're sitting next to as to whether you think that's a good idea, and it depends on the air conditioning as to whether it'll be good for all of us in a little while or not. However, the question of conflict in the hearts and minds of people is very strong, and especially approach avoidance conflicts, and there's no greater example of it than the subject of work. We love it and we hate it at the same time. Every Monday we experience the avoidance conflict, don't we? It's called Mondayitis. You see it as you go to work, don't you? When people talk to you, what do they talk to you about work? Well, they tell you what they did last week from Monday and Tuesday, and on Wednesday through Friday they tell you what they're going to do next weekend. But really all the time you're at work, all you're discussing has got to do with the weekend. Yet at the same time we know that we can't do without work, and the rising and mounting unemployment in our community is showing the devastating effects upon people of unemployment, of being unable to get a job, of being unwanted in the workforce. It has tremendous debilitating effects upon people socially and economically and even physically, psychologically. And so our society is doing a great rethink on work, and especially now that we have such growing and increasing and seemingly structural unemployment. We're talking of the 35-hour week, we're talking of job sharing, we're discussing the questions of trying to resolve the terrible problems of the thousands and millions of man hours we lose each year in industrial unrest. We're trying to sort out boredom and tedium in people's work and the stress that is created by the workforce. But the question of work is not just a big social problem like that. The question of work is a personal problem for you and for me. About a third of our lifetime is going to be spent at work. About a half of our conscious waking lifetime is spent at work. A half of the time I am here on this earth with my eyes open and my mind working, assuming that it does most of the time my eyes are open, about half of that time is going to be spent at work. It is a very personal problem, the question of work. What am I going to do? Why am I doing it? For whom am I going to do it? For what reason and hope am I going to do it? What am I involved in my work? And it's a great problem for you and I, all the more so as unemployment crowds in and graduate unemployment crowds in, as to what am I really choosing to do and why am I choosing to do? And of course, for many of us who are halfway through our course, why on earth did I make the choice I did 2 years ago or 3 years ago? And can I get back out of it now? And we've linked in our society work with status and significance. It's very important to us that we have work that is fulfilling and satisfying. And we think that the idea of work, the whole concept of it, must be in some way related to my person. That if I can do important, worthwhile, satisfying work, that then in some degree I am worthwhile and important. And life is satisfying and full. And we as uni students in particular are getting sucked into this whole career orientation, whereby we think that there will be importance in what we do and that we will become important because we're involved in things that are valuable, that are worthwhile, that are significant, and the society will be thankful to us, and we get caught into the career whereby we know at the age of 25 we should be a grade 1 engineer, and grade 30 we should be grade 2, and grade 35 we should be grade 3, and we've got it all planned out before us. Even if we don't plan it, the company will, as to where we'll be. And the company does plan where we'll be, where we'll live, what house, what kind of house we live in, what kind of woman we marry or husband we marry, what kind of number of children we have. All kinds of things have to be tailored into the success of my career. My career doesn't occupy and dominate just the hours I'm awake at work. It starts to really take over and dominate my whole life and my lifestyle. It's like that ultimate symbol of success and importance in our community called the bleeper. I'm sorry if you've got one on you at the moment, because I'm going to be rude for a moment, but you know the bleeper that you can see people walking around? If you're given a bleeper by your employment, you must be very important, because they can't do without you. They must always be able to get in contact with you at the moment's notice. You see, some disaster will come upon society and you will be bleeped wherever you are. And I hope for your sake and ours you're not in the middle now, because it's very inconvenient. Here's bzz, 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 bzz. And you can always pick an important person because he's got a bleeper hanging out of... This is not a bleeper, that's the microphone. Because he has a bleeper hanging out of his pocket and you know he's important. I think it is the ultimate in the ball and chain, isn't it? You cannot be in greater slavery and servitude to your boss than to have a bleeper attached to your system. Where everywhere you go, he can give all the whistle and call you in like a little sheepdog because the sheep have got out of the pen again. It is the ultimate in servitude. That ultimate symbol of significance. The Bible has great perspective on the subject of work. And it's such a personal matter, it's perspective on our life too, in work. The Bible's answer is the point that we're making throughout this whole 2 weeks of period, we'll be sharing at Sydney University, that to know Christ is to know life. But if we are to say no to Christ, then we do not enjoy life. We do not have life. And that is true in every aspect of our life, in work, in sex, in leisure, in death, all the subjects I'll be speaking of this week. That is, tomorrow as we speak about it, that our sexuality is affected by whether we know Christ or whether we have said no to Christ. Our leisure, as we speak it on Thursday, our death, it's all affected by it. And our work, well, I'll share it with you today under the Bible's perspectives. There are four themes of the Bible that I draw to your attention that relate to work. Four great themes which will show that to know Christ will mean that you know life, and more importantly, as I'll be speaking on it, that if you do not know Christ, you do not know life. The first theme is undoubtedly the beginning, because it's the theme of creation. God has created everything in this world, and he has created you and I as part of this world. We are his creatures. He owns us. He's made us for his own reasons. We are for him. And God creates us in a unique place in the world. He has created the world as a pleasurable place for man's existence, with food, with beauty, with work and rest, with satisfaction and companionship. But the world is created for man to enjoy, because the man is the one part of creation that is uniquely like God. Man is set up as the ruler of the world, as God is the ultimate ruler. And man, in his ruling the world, has to rule it under the authority of God. He is like God and must rule it as God would rule it. And he must rule it under God's authority. Therefore, in our work, man reflects the character, the likeness of God. God is a working God. Therefore, man is to be a worker. God works 6 days and rests one. And therefore, man is to also follow that same pattern of work and rest in balance with each other and separation from each other. God works generously, caring for his creation, and especially for man. And so we are to work, caring for creation, and especially for each other. God works in fellowship with himself, and we are called upon to work in fellowship with each other, in companionship with each other. And so, on the inside of this pink sheet that is handed out today, there are some Bible verses, and I'll refer to them on time in passing. I couldn't fit any more on the sheet, otherwise you'd have a few more. But there's a few there, and you'll see that God puts man in the garden in the first one, and he puts them in the garden to work. But notice the nature of the work is to care for the garden. Man is to work as God works, caring for his creation. Man is created like that. And you'll see in the second one from the Ten Commandments that man is to work, and he is to rest, for that is the character of God, to work and to rest. Therefore, work is not a curse in the Bible. Work is part of the way we are created. It is fundamental to our nature. Humans are working parts of creation. And not to work will be a denial of our nature. And that is why we truly expect, Christians must expect, that unemployment will have a devastating effect upon people. Because we are created to work. It is part and parcel of our very existence to be workers. Yet, it's not all there is to life. There's more to life than work. Work must be balanced with rest, with leisure, of which we'll speak on Thursday. We're to enjoy life and enjoy work, and we're to enjoy our life and work in companionship with each other, and especially in sexual companionship. And the manner of our work must reflect the character of God. So the first great theme about man and the world and life in the scriptures that I put forward to you is the theme of creation, and it affects our work. The second theme is that of rebellion. The Bible teaches that all people rebel against God. None of us want to live God's way, we all want to live our own way. We want to rule the world, but we want to rule the world independently of God, doing my own thing, as Sinatra put it so beautifully, my way. This is always rebellion against God. It can be an active, intentional rebellion. So I say, I know God wants me to do X, and I'm not going to do X. Or I know he doesn't want me to do Y, and I'm going to do it. It can be intentional and active like that. It can be just a passive indifference. So I don't give a bump of what God says. I'm just going to do what I want to do. But either way, if God is God, then it is a rejection of God. It is a rebellion about God, be it just thoughtlessness, that I couldn't care about my Creator, or be it intentional perversity and rebelliousness against him. It is still rebellion against God. Furthermore, the Bible would see that we are all involved in this rebellion. Every individual in the world, every one of us who are here, I don't know you, but I know that you're sinful. Without even knowing you, I can know that much, because everybody is. You don't know me, but you can know I am too. But I'll give you plenty of examples of that during the week. We are all, each one of us, rebellious against God. That is our basic characteristic in life, is to not want God running our lives, but to want to run our own lives our own way. The Bible does not say that there are some good people in the world and there are some wicked people in the world, and the wicked ones are the ones who muck it all up. We often think that way, especially about politicians. You know, Adolf Fraser and Eddie Rand. And we think they muck it up all the time for what are basically good people. I'm sorry if you belong to the Democrats and I left you out. I'll save you up for later. They basically muck it up. It's not that the Bible says. The Bible says each and every one of us is like that. And the Bible doesn't say that people are good, but the structures and institution and society are evil. Of the great enlightenment idea, that's not enlightenment, that's darkness. That's nonsense that the system is good, but the system is bad while the people are good. The Bible says every one of us individually chooses to go against God. And that affects not only every one of us, but every part of our lives. It will affect our leisure, it affects our sex, it affects our work. In our work situation, let me pick a simple example to start with, and then we'll point to a couple of other areas in which you and I are rebellious to God about work. Take the idea of theft. Now, the Bible's quite clear on the subject of theft. The Ten Commandments says you shall not steal. There's a quote there in Ephesians chapter 4. I don't know where it is on the page, bottom left-hand page. He who has been stealing must steal no longer, but must work with doing something useful with his own hands that he may have something to share with those in need. The Bible's quite explicit, you're not to steal. It is also ungodly to steal. See, what is God like? God is a generous giver. That is how God works, generously giving. How does the thief work? Selfishly taking. It's the exact antithesis of godliness, is to be involved in theft. And every time a person involves himself in theft, whether he is thinking about God at the time or ignoring God at the time, he is rejecting God's way of living. God says the best way for you to live in your situation is not to steal. And the man is saying, I'm going to steal. I know what's best in my situation. The best thing for me now is to steal. And so theft is always rebellion against God. And of course it can be done in many ways. It's not just the break and enter, is it? There's also the white collar crime and the manipulation and embezzlement that can be so cleverly done by clever people. There's also the taxation swindles of which we're all can be so easily given to come this time of year. There can be just the stealing of time from our employer which we're all given to come the vacation, in the long vacation, because the work he gives us to do is so boring and we're so disinterested in it, and the chatting on to the people around about us, or the nicking off early, or the spending longer time reading our novel in the toilet is so much more attractive. There's lots of ways in which we can steal, and we all know how to do it, for we all do it. But it's not just there are certain actions of work which are ungodly. It's a whole range of things too. Our motives can be ungodly in work. See, if I set myself up as the one who establishes the values of life, if I decide to do my life my way, then at the centre of the universe is me. It's not God, it's me. And therefore my work cannot help but be selfishness. It's self-centeredness. I will be seeking to acquire, through the manner of work, comfort for myself. And the whole basis of our godless society is a basis of greed, isn't it? whereby people are trying to acquire for themselves things, clothes, furniture, food, better clothes, better furniture, food, ultimate clothes, ultimate furniture, ultimate food. But we're just getting more and more of things for myself, because the centre of the work is me. I am the God of this universe, this little one over here anyway. You are the gods of yours. And the whole nature of the work is greed. It can be, of course, the very sophisticated greed, not of a materialist nature, but of satisfaction, of status, of importance and value within the community, so that people will say, you're a good man, you've done a good job, so that you can write your initials after your name as well as in front of your name, and so that people can be very bowing and grateful to you. We all know that pecking order, don't we? It's within the community. You introduce yourself as a street sweeper and see how people treat you. I'm sure it's different than if you introduce yourself as a dentist or something like that. You know it within this community, don't you? There are those faculties at which every knee bows and every head confesses that this man is truly God on earth, that he was able to get in, let alone pass. And then there's civil engineering as well. I'm sorry. But I figured of all the people on the campus, you are the least sensitive. Now, that pecking order, you see, has got to do with our ungodly view. It's our self-centred view of work. That we use our work to aggrandise ourselves, to build ourselves up as important. But it's an inevitability of putting yourself on the throne of life. Or again, it's not just the methods. It can actually be caught in the way in which we, not just the motives, it can be caught in the methods of our work too. See, God gives a clear balance. Work 6 days, rest one. Keep the two separate. But yet, you and I are being captured and being pulled into a system, not of laziness really, but of the exact reverse, of becoming workaholics, of working 7 days a week, of eight if we can manage it. We are being called upon to do overtime all the time, and to be thought of that we are so important that the work won't continue, that actually the whole world will fall apart unless I am there. I am one of the indispensable men. Well, I've got lots of forefathers, most of them are in the graveyard, but I am one of those indispensable men that must be there from the crack of dawn to the dead of night. And this whole institution works on the basis of teaching people to work on weekends, teaching them to work longer than their 40 hours, teaching them to confuse work and rest and recreation until they're caught in the terrible bind of workaholicism, which is a disastrous thing overcoming our society. Well, the second great theme is that we are all rebellious. Each one of us wants to do it our way. The third theme of the Bible is the theme of judgment. The third one is the theme of judgment. For God, who cares for his world and his creatures, cannot and will not allow men to continue to rebel against him. If we say no to Christ running our lives, then God says no to us having life. No in this world, and no in the next. You see, what happens in this world is God answers our rebellion. He says, you don't want me to run your life? All right, you go run it yourself and see what a mess you make of it. And we do, as I'll share with you in a moment. But more than that, he will in the end act in the future to stop the rebellion by death. Death in this world, death in the next. Look at the consequences now of our rebellion. In our work situation, we'll keep it in that context. Look at the consequences of it. For our greed gives forth to this materialistic society of which we are living and of which we are rightly disgusted as long as we're not caught up into the rat race. 1 or 2 years after graduation, you're so caught in it, you're no longer disgusted by it. But yet, when you are separated from it, you can see it, and you can see its soullessness and its mindlessness and its stupidity, like the Women's Weekly or the Women's Day or Poll or the TV advertisements that tell you that you need more food, more clothes, you need better food and better clothes. They are constantly filling you with all the advertisements of consumerism, that you cannot exist unless you have product A or product B. Notice the words of Jesus there that we see in the last of the quotations from Matthew 6. Surely there is more to life than your food. There is more to life than your clothes. Surely there is more to life than what you tickle your tonsils with. There must be more than what you shove down the food chute. For all that you shove down the food chute gets shoved down the toilet, and if that's all you're living for, you're living for the toilet. But yet you look at the expenditure of people in their time, in their labour, in their life, just to acquire the ultimate sensation to their palate, the beauties of their cooking. They're living for the extravagance of food, while people in Eritrea and Kampuchea and all over the world are dying of starvation. We are feeding more food to our animals and devising multi-tastes for them as well, which they with X-ray eyes can see. We live in a society, you see, where people want to say, look, there's no God. All there is material existence. There's just a world that is just matter. You might call it energy, particles, or whatever is the latest fad or fashion. I'm never up on those things. But it's just matter that is here. There is nothing else but our material existence. And then we wonder why it is that people are materialists. If you're materialistic philosophically, you're bound to be a materialist in your lifestyle. All you will live is for what you can shove in your food chute. Why would you care about anybody else? You will exploit, you'll manipulate, you'll destroy and pollute, and if you can get away with it, why not get away with it? For there is nothing else in this life except my matter. That's the only matter that matters to me. Or indeed, if we overvalue work as we so oftenly do, we destroy ourselves and we destroy our society, we destroy other people. For when we start to value people by the basis of what they can do, we don't value people as people anymore, we value them by their utility. We think this person is an important person because he does an important job, and we think this person is an unimportant person because he does a trivial, menial job. And we put distinctions within our society, a distinctions of the meritocracy, which are infinitely worse than the aristocracy that we replaced it with. That was nobody's fault but the meritocracy. It's my fault that I'm at the bottom of the ladder and the bottom of the scale, that I'm the scum of the earth. Because I am a failure, and our whole education system is built on this competitiveness. You and I didn't feel it in primary school. We didn't even notice it existed then. But that's because we were the success stories. Many a child in primary school is told he's a failure, he's no good, he can't do anything. It's not just that he fails his exams, he's a failure. Because if you can't pass exams, you're a nobody, you're a nothing in this world. And that went on through secondary school when some of us started to feel the pinch a bit. And why you're reaching anxiety and uncertainty at this stage is because at university, one third of you don't make it. Spoke to one of the vice chancellors of one of the universities of Australia, and he said, two thirds of our campus pass. I said, marvellous, what happens to the other third? He said, I don't know, I don't care. Really doesn't matter what the other third happened. And they're failures. It's not just they failed exams, they're failures. You may be one of them soon. It's not they actually choose to drop out. They're actually people who have been discarded by the process. But don't worry, the competition is stiff when you leave campus. You haven't seen anything yet. Very few people make it to the top. Anxiety is what is produced to this. Anxiety and overwork and ulcers and heart attacks as we struggle and strive to elbow each other out of the way so as to be able to prove that we are a good workman, a professional person, capable. We're worthwhile. We're a success. It's fairly easy for most of us because we are. But it's ruthless because of what we have done to other people in process. We ruin ourselves and we ruin others. But that's not really the consequence. The consequences are worse than all that. Don't worry. Because the consequence of our rejection of God is not only that our lifestyle now is disfigured from what God would have us to enjoy, but we are facing with death itself. For we are all to die. The reason we all die, friends, is because we all rebel. And see, it's utterly just what God says and what God does. Because what is death but separation from God? You say, I don't want you to run my life, God. God says, all right, you go without me. He is the author of life. You can't go without him for long. The punishment fits the crime perfectly. We asked for it, literally. And we get it. And death is a terrible mocker of all our activities, of all our achievements, of all our acquisitions and of all our pleasures. Death robs us and destroys us of anything that we ever thought was worthwhile, of anything we ever thought was worth having. Notice Jesus' pungent comment, the second last one on the right-hand page there. What good is it for a man to gain the whole world and yet forfeit his life? Hey, what do you get if you've gained everything and you drop dead? Tell you what you get a box that's 6 foot by 2 by 2, which is pine, covered with veneer and plastic handles that look silver. That is what you get. And they lower it down 6 feet beneath the ground, and there you rot until the worms get through the box and are able to eat you, and the ducks eat the worms, and we eat the ducks, and so we've eaten you. I won't sing the song for you for your sake. What do you get when you die? And in case you are too stingy in your acquisition to ever spend your money on a funeral, you can actually do it on a cremation instead of a burial. And then you get a little box with ashes and a couple of shin bones, because they don't burn down too well, stuck in a wall, in a niche in a wall, with a plaque across the front of it. And make sure you haven't got too many degrees, because they won't be able to fit it on the plaque. They're very tiny. Unless, of course, they print it with such small print that no one can read it. But don't worry about it, no one will bother reading your niche anyway, because you're just one of thousands of niches in thousands of walls. Walk around the crematorium, have a look, go and check out the funerals, go and go to the places of death, for that is where wisdom lies, not in the house of folly. The house of folly gives you one thing, folly. Go to the house of death, that is where you find wisdom, that is where you find the meaning of life and the purpose of life, and what do you find? It's meaningless. That's what you find. It's purposeless. For death makes a mockery of everything I've ever done or thought or wanted or hoped for or worked for. It's all nonsense. Look at the writer Ecclesiastes, the longest quote that you've got there in front of you on the page, on the left-hand page. He says, I hated life because the work that was done under the sun was grievous to me. All of it is meaningless. He says, look, I work with all the skill that is available, wisdom, knowledge and skill. And what happens? I die and I leave everything that I've accumulated to some other twit who goes and uses it all in ways that I would never, spends it and throws it away. All that I have done is left behind for some indolent fool. Where is the value of my work if I'm going to die? But it's worse than that. It's worse than that. For it's not only that I die, but God says that I am cut off from him eternally. I'm not annihilated. That could be lived with possibly. But I'm actually to be cut off with him forever. And all that is good, all that is worthwhile, loving, kind, true, all that goes, because that is all part of God. And you say, well, that sounds a little bit like hell. I'm glad you got the message. That is what it's about. And you say, well, I don't like hell. It doesn't surprise me in the slightest. Who would? But I don't like you talking about hell. That's all right. I'll talk more about it in the coming days. You must come again. But you say, I'd prefer if there wasn't a hell. Think again about that. For hell is a marvellous truth. You see, if there's no hell, life is meaningless and pointless and futile, just like the existentialist writers say, just like Ecclesiastes says. But if there is hell, then there is a value system, isn't there? Then what I do in my life actually matters. It's worthwhile. Then I am treated not like as a piece of mindless matter, but I am treated as a responsible being, a person who is going to be called into responsibility for my least and most and greatest and smallest actions. Hell finds meaning and purpose in life. Don't throw away hell just because you don't like the possibility you're going there. Because the idea itself actually gives value to the very existence of life. Look at 1 Corinthians 15. There are two quotes there on the top right-hand page. The first one's the men who don't believe there's anything after life. There's just death. That's all it is. And Paul, I won't go into the fighting of the wild beasts in Ephesus, but Paul says, you see, if the dead are not raised, then we may as well eat, drink and be merry, for tomorrow we die, and there's nothing else to life, is there? You may as well titillate the senses as much as you can, and as long as you can, and as frequently as you can, for there's nothing else to this existence than the excitement of my senses. And if I can do that with any form of medication, if I can do that with electrical activity, if I can do it with whatever I can space myself out with, so much the better for me, for there's nothing else. But notice what he says at the end of the chapter after he's talked about the resurrection of Jesus. He says, my dear brother, stand firm, let nothing move you. Always give yourself fully to the work of the Lord, because you know that your labour in the Lord is not in vain. Once you understand that Jesus is risen from the dead, that there is life after death, then the work we do now starts to take on a meaning and purpose and value. That all my activity is worth something now. Worth for good or for ill, but it's worth something. The resurrection of the dead of Jesus brings new character to the nature of the life, which brings me to the fourth great theme, that is Jesus himself. And it's the greatest and most important of the themes. And it's the one that John is speaking on each night when he speaks of knowing Christ. It is the great theme because Jesus was a worker. Jesus came to do the works of his Father, and he did them faithfully because Jesus, unlike the rest of us, was not rebellious to God. He didn't work his way, he worked God's way in everything he did. And what did he work if he worked God's way? He worked as a generous one. He says, though I was rich, yet he became poor so that we in our poverty might become rich. See, Jesus was generous in his work. More than that, he was self-sacrificial. He served other people. Jesus said of himself, I come not to be served, but to serve, and give my life as a ransom for many. He doesn't come just to gain for himself, but to give for us. And what is it he gives? His life as a ransom for many. Jesus, the one who does not deserve death, dies in my place and in your place. Jesus dies as a sacrifice for our rebellion. He takes my punishment upon himself, and he liberates me from the death that I truly deserve. He dies as a ransom for me. That is the work he came to do. It wasn't a very pleasant work. It, in actual fact, was terribly unpleasant, for he had to suffer the separation from his Father, whom he loved and whom he served faithfully and loyally all of eternity. He had to separate himself from God the Father, that I may be forgiven. And that death's not the end of the story with Jesus, because he is raised up again to new life, to become the ruler of the world and the judge of every man's life and every action in this world. See, Jesus changes the very character of everything we do in life, because Jesus brings, firstly, forgiveness. Forgiveness for all that I have done wrong, for my greed, for my selfishness, for my competitiveness. Oh, you think I'm not really greedy and selfish? Well, you don't know me very well. I know me, I am, and I know you too. You don't think I know you? I know that you're greedy and selfish and ambitious. Haven't you ever felt a twinge of envy? Haven't you ever felt the twinge of jealousy when you've seen other people get on? Have you always been able to rejoice at the good news of other people's success? Of course you haven't. Face up to yourself. We're all that self-centered and ambitious. And all that is being forgiven by Jesus, because he died for it. Because all those things are the symptom of the disease we have. The symptom of our rebellion against God, of setting ourselves up as the centre of the universe instead of God as the centre of our universe. And that rebellion, which manifests itself in our work, that rebellion is forgiven because Jesus has died for it. He took the consequences upon himself, that I may be forgiven. And more than that, it changes my whole lifestyle in work and in every other part of life, as we'll see in the coming days. For with Christ I have a new lifestyle now here. Our work has value and meaning because death is not the last word. The grave and the tomb is not the last word. Jesus is the last word now. And so our whole life and its work takes on meaning and purpose in him. More than that, our value system is radically changed, dramatically changed. You see, a man is now valuable to me not because of what he can do for society or for me, or for himself for that matter. A man is valuable because God has created him in his own image. A man is valuable because Jesus was willing to die for him. Every man is valuable. The dentist, the street sweeper, the surgeon, the plumber, if you can differentiate those two. The surgeon and the plumber, they are all equally valuable because they're valuable as the creation of God. They're valuable as the person that God has bought back at the price of his own son. Their value has got nothing to do with their work and utility. My work is worthwhile. But I'm not acceptable just because I work. I'm acceptable because of God's attitude. I am valuable whether I'm a success or a failure in the competitive world of work. All I'm called upon to be is faithful to the tasks at hand, to do them honestly and openly like God would. That is the nature of my work now. Very different. I don't have to achieve. For I am already accepted. He takes me as, think about it, God takes me as I am. That is how I want my friends to take me, isn't it? God does that for me by sending his son to die for me and rise again. And it's not just in this lifetime. The consequences are not just for now, but for all eternity. God treats me like that. To know Christ is to know life as it is meant to be lived. But if you say no to Christ, then you say no to life as it's meant to be lived and face death, and death which is eternal in its consequences. So the four themes of the Bible actually give you two ways of going. The first way is to say no to Christ. I'm not going to have Christ running my life. I'm good at running it myself. I'm going to keep running it myself. Well, at best, if Christianity is right, then your life is meaningless and futile. So you may as well enjoy it while you've got it, because it's quickly passing. At worst, if Christianity is right, then your life is futile for eternity. But there's an alternative way of living, that is to know Christ. Because Jesus is not just dead in Palestine somewhere, he has risen again and alive, and he's coming to judge the world, and we can enter into a relationship with him now. And how can I know Christ? Well, there are three things to do. The first thing is to pray. That is what we must do. We must pray to God that God will forgive me and that he will change me. I need forgiveness for the many things I've done wrong. Even in my work situation, without going on to sex and leisure and death, I need God to forgive me now. And I need to be changed too in the way in which I live and treat other people. So the first thing I've got to do is pray that. Secondly, I've got to trust Jesus. I've got to trust that because Jesus died for me, I will be forgiven and accepted by God. And I've got to trust Jesus that because he has risen to new life, he will give me the power to change me and to change my life. So I've got to pray to God that he will forgive me and change me and trust that Jesus will do those things. And thirdly, submit my life to Jesus. I've got to stop living my life my way and start living my life his way. That is what I've got to do. Now that kind of thing that needs to be done is actually printed out for us in a prayer on the bottom of the right-hand side of that pink sheet. And I know it's not very common to pray in these lecture theatres, but I'm going to pray in this lecture theatre. I'm going to pray out loud and I'm going to pray that prayer because I believe there are people here who will know that they need to change their lives, who will know that they are actually going nowhere but death because they have not got Jesus Christ as their Lord and Master, who know it's true but have been living away from him. And I want to give you the opportunity of making that change and making it right now, because becoming a Christian will take only but a moment for the person who can sincerely pray a prayer like this one. And so I'm going to pray that prayer. And if you want to pray that prayer with me, then you pray it in the silence of your own mind. You can pray it out loud if you want to, but pray it in the silence of your mind. It won't disturb your neighbour so much. Pray in the silence of your mind to God, who hears what you are praying. Because if you want to know Jesus, then you need to pray to him and trust and submit. That is what we need to do. Let's just close our eyes if you'd like to do that. I certainly won't, because I'm reading. You might like to read it, you might like to bow your head, but if you'll see that prayer, I'll now pray it. And if you want to join in coming to know Jesus, then you pray it with me. God, I know I'm not worthy to be called a child of God. I don't deserve your gift of eternal life. I'm guilty of rebelling against you and ignoring you. And I need forgiveness. Thank you for sending your Son to die for me, that I may be forgiven. Thank you that you raised Jesus to give me new life. Please forgive me and change me, that I may live with Jesus as my Lord and Master. Amen. If you prayed that prayer today, friends, and you meant that thing, then on the comment card that I hope everybody will fill out some comment just to give us some feedback of what we're saying and to talk further and answer some questions possibly in the coming days, please feel free to please tick that little box about praying the prayer and give us your name and address. And I'll tell you why. Because we'd like to be in contact with you if you prayed that prayer to help you. More than that, immediately now, I'll be leaving and going underneath Stephen Roberts Theatre and be happy to answer questions of people there. But if you prayed that prayer and you can come over and talk to me about it now, we would love to talk with you to help you. I'll introduce you to some Christian friend who might be able to share with you, and we'll give you some literature. We want to do this only to help you. That is what we're trying to do, to help you as you start your life as a Christian. And so if you prayed that prayer, please come over and have a chat to us there. All you need to do is bowl up to me and say, oh, Philip, my name's whatever it is, and I prayed that prayer, and I will introduce you to someone who can help you. If you've got a 2 o'clock lecture and you can't do that, well, if you tick the box on the yellow comment card and drop it in one of the cardboard boxes that are at the doors, then we'd be happy to ring you up and make contact with you in a day or two so as to be able to talk with you. If you've got questions that you can't again stay because of the 2 o'clock lecture, but you'd like to talk further about Christianity, there is another box there which says, I would like to know more about the claims of Jesus. And if you tick that and leave your name and address, we're happy to contact you and spend with you whatever time you deem necessary to answer your questions. Tomorrow, we'll be speaking again on knowing Christ, and I'll be suggesting to you that if you say no to Christ, you actually say no to life in an area so important to you as your own sexuality. I do hope you'll be here. And I know it's hard to believe, but I hope you'll bring your friends because there's plenty of desk space yet to sit on. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the talks on philipjensen.com. Please check our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material on philipjensen.com.